Good morning and welcome.
That's so good. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to the Hope This Helps podcast. It is morning, probably. There's a good chance it is morning if you are listening to this, or it could be night. I don't really care what time it is. It is, what day even is it? It is Thursday, July 16th, 2020. EHLO, helpies. This is the IT sysadmin podcast with questionable direction from all angles, but we are here nonetheless. My name is Steve.
And I'm Tiffany.
We are glad to have you along again. If you have suffered through with us all this time, we are back again. Woohoo to you, and woohoo to us. We have stuff to talk about, as we usually do every week or every time we record. We are going to be talking about things like Teams, more security patches, modern auth, dark web things, Outlook outages, etiquette at work, and useless obsolete knowledge that you didn't ask for, all coming up shortly on Hope This Helps, along with maybe some That Is Accurate and maybe a sponsor or two.
All right, let's get started. It's been quite an eventful day. One day, 24 hours.
Yeah, seriously, like how much stuff can happen in a certain time frame or day or 48 hours? I don't know. There's too much stuff to count because I'm still getting over the DNS vulnerability, but apparently Twitter blew up in the past day.
And there was an Outlook outage?
That one I didn't even know about until literally 2 minutes ago when you put it in the show notes, so I'm curious about that one.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a huge outage.
Oh, all right. I guess I must have slept through it or something.
I mean, it was a big day yesterday. It was also my birthday.
Everything happens on your birthday. That was Microsoft's gift to you, which was to kill Outlook for the whole day in honor of the day of birth.
It knew I needed the day off.
You didn't miss anything. It's back today, at least.
It's very true. It's a good thing I don't run the click-to-run version of Outlook or Office.
Oh, boy. See, I do. I do on everything. So I'm actually kind of amazed. I was not as affected as others apparently were.
Well, it's the current channel. So if you're not running the current channel, dating back to the June 30th version, so it's the 2006 build 13001-2026.
And you know what? There is a fair chance that I am not running the current channel. I don't know. I think I'm just running channel of click to run. Usually it just works for me, but usually every time I open it, something changes also. So who knows what version I'm running.
Yeah, there's different channels that you can that your tenant could be subscribed to. So like,
that
there's the
sense.
Monthly, there's the like every 3 months, there's various ones.
It might be the every 3 months one, I think, because that sounds roughly just in my memory when things often change, usually for a couple of months, and then suddenly a button or two moves or something. Or there's maybe a search box that wasn't there before.
Yeah, the search box definitely was very alerting. I was like, what is this? Why?
Well, now you can search, even though you could search before, but now there might be two search boxes, and one search box might be better than the other search box.
Well, speaking of searches, now that I just thought of it, you can now do Control F in Teams.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Was that the context search that they announced?
Yes.
That is cool. So maybe I can find something in Teams, because currently it's kind of hard to find stuff in Teams.
Right. And now you can, right in that little search box, you can do the nice Control F shortcut.
Now, if only they could make it so if you scrolled up in Teams, you didn't get a blank screen at least 75% of the time, then maybe Teams would get a little better for me.
That would be nice. Maybe someday.
Other things Teams doesn't do. So I don't know about you, but Teams notifications does not pay attention to focus assist or do not disturb or quiet hours or whatever it's called now in Windows 10. No matter what I do, no matter what meeting I join, there is always someone blowing me up on Teams, and that notification cuts through whatever suppression I have set. It seems the only thing I can really do is maybe turn on Do Not Disturb or turn off notifications altogether. But that's really bugging me in Teams.
I'm wondering if it's just you. I don't have that problem.
Yeah, maybe it's me. Maybe it's the EDU version of Teams. But I saw something on Twitter somewhere saying that native notifications were coming soon to Teams, which is something that I'm pretty sure that you and I were sitting in a room at a Teams training once, and they were talking about this at least 2 years ago, about rolling this out to Windows 10. And I think we're still waiting on it to come up, as far as I know.
Oh, yeah. No, many things that we learned in that training 2 years ago are just now finally coming.
Which is driving me nuts, because I'm like, I was ready for this. I was ready for this in 2018.
Like the calendaring and the pop-out chats, so waiting for that so long ago.
It's nutty. I don't understand what is taking so long. Why announce it and why demo it and why show it if, you know, we're not going to see it for literally 2 years.
Right. And I'm waiting for breakout rooms too. Please.
Someday things will come to Teams.
Right.
That's Teams. It's always Teamsy. Enough about Teams. Let's go to one of the huge things that happened this week. Your DNS is showing. So DNS.
Why? Why?
So for everyone's DNS, it is out. It is exposed. It is vulnerable.
Cover it up, please.
Cover it up. You can either patch it or you can mitigate it with a temporary workaround. But make sure after you apply the real patch, you undo the workaround so you're not double buffered or you have unexpected side effects due to the temporary workaround on your DNS.
Oh my God. I can't. All
Welcome right. to Hope This Helps. We just make phallic jokes out of security vulnerabilities.
Terrible. Terrible jokes.
Yes. So where do we even begin with this? I am not a DNS expert. We'll just start that out straight right off the bat. I did the best I could to read about this patch, but DNS makes me feel very stupid every time I read about it. For some reason, it's just something I can't wrap my head around.
Well, it's just a lot of gibberish.
Yes. So in the show notes, I linked one of the super, super lengthy technical details for detailing this vulnerability. And wow, it's a doozy. It's long. It is very informative. I understood some of it. I definitely don't understand the rest of it. The short of it is, if you can compromise one of your DNS servers, which may be one or many domain controllers in your environment, you can effectively turn that one system into a DNS master controlling server thingy. It's wormable, which can turn all your other DNS servers or devices in your environment into effectively DNS clients, and you can basically manipulate them to do whatever you please with DNS, which may include but not be limited to dropping all your DNS records or redirecting them to malicious places or all sorts of really nasty things.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. So if you have not patched your servers, do so.
I believe on the scale of severity, it was rated a 10 out of 10. So it is very, very, very important this patch get released. If you are in a situation where you cannot currently patch your servers, there is a registry workaround, which is also fairly easily applied. You just have to add a key, which normally isn't there, and you restart your DNS service. If you have multiple DNS servers, you just do one at a time, and you will not even suffer an outage. If you have one, maybe just schedule some brief downtime or for a quick blip in setting that. But that is the temporary workaround. Once you have the permanent fix ready to install, that being the actual patch for this CVE, you may need to undo that registry key that you set. While it's not necessarily going to immediately break things, Microsoft just recommends that you take it out due to potential future fixes or changes made in DNS, and it may be an unintentional side effect if you just leave it in there. So keep track of this workaround if you put it in. It's literally only one registry key, so it's not a big deal.
Very tiny. Just do it.
A little change goes a long way in mitigating this threat.
Oh, yeah. Especially because the CVE notes definitely say this is wormable, like in the nicest way possible. It's like, do this now or else bad things can happen.
Yeah, it is funny. I remember the previous wormable CVE thing. I think it was the RDP bug.
And
I remember
yeah.
that was worded a lot more strongly. But ironically, I think this one is actually more immediately dangerous. But yet the language is just kind of, you know, just make sure you patch. It's something you should do now, but do it soon.
Yeah, please. As soon as possible. Please. Hope this helps.
So next in our grab bag of stuff, Exchange Online PowerShell and executing unattended scripts. Microsoft has done some work on this in the brand new ExoV2 PowerShell module, where there's more better support for MFA enabled accounts and tokens and all kinds of stuff like that. More, you know, things like that. I personally have not been able to test this because not quite there yet on the MFA front. But if you do have MFA, this is going to be nothing but helpful for you for sure.
Oh, yeah. Nothing is worse than those MFA prompts for PowerShell.
Oh, yes. And it's just nothing but a pain if you're just trying to get a scheduled script running as a scheduled task somewhere and you're just getting hurtled by all of this
right.
Security, which I understand. But nonetheless, it's still in the way sometimes.
And especially if you're going to get audited and they're like, why is this one account not MFA enabled? And you're like, oh, by the way, that's a service account.
It's like, oh, yeah.
About that.
So you know what they, you know, and you know about service accounts. It's like, it is a good, you know, I understand, you know, keeping it one big long password forever and ever. But if that gets compromised and it's, I don't know, domain admin, exchange admin, org admin, any of that, you might be in trouble. You can either maybe elect to put in a workaround where, say, this account is only on-premise and you will have an MFA policy in Azure set to not enforce MFA if the account is used on-premise on on-premise servers, and enforce MFA otherwise in other locations, which is kind of your choice. It has its ups and downs in terms of security. Or it can enable MFA globally across the board, in which Microsoft is starting to better enable the PowerShell modules, at least for Exchange, to support that and run unattended scripts.
Yes, it's getting there.
It is. That is modern auth unattended Exchange things.
All the things.
Oh, jeez. Let's talk about 15 billion credentials available on the dark web.
Do you know how much they're going for?
No. Well,
I
have the article up in front of me. I'm seeing below $16.
Yeah, it's not very much. I mean, you can make more at Target.
That's true, yeah. If you work for an hour at Target, you can get somebody's login. That sounds like a good deal to me. Maybe
right.
It's a bank account.
Oh, good point. You just work enough to then pay for stealing someone else's stuff?
Yeah, effectively. You know the game that you can play on Wikipedia where you start on some random article and you try to get to this other completely unrelated article by only clicking the links in each article as you go?
Yes.
So if you can imagine that, but just with social engineering and hacking like this, so you start at working like, I don't know, like, waste management, or you start as a garbage man, you make like your hour of pay, you get your first paycheck. Okay, let's hop on the dark web. I know a couple of people who know some websites. Let's get a couple of creds. Let's grab those creds. What the first cred is, say, a bank account, a high profile Twitter account, and something else. Those can get you money and fame. So now you have those, you update the MFA and everything, and maybe you can SIM swap along the way, and then suddenly you have redirected phone numbers and messages, which then it just bumps you up and up and up.
Wow, this sounds oddly familiar.
Yeah, that's usually how, unfortunately, that's how a lot of cybercrime works, it seems. You know, SIM swap, you know, social engineering,
yeah.
SIM swapping, and about 15 people on Twitter who got blown up yesterday.
Right, yeah. Bitcoin. Pay the Bitcoins.
Bitcoin took out, you know, such prominent figures such as Bill Gates, Apple, Wiz Khalifa, the core people. They all somehow
the core
fell victim to this.
the top 10. I mean, my MySpace top 8.
Tom.
Yes, Tom.
I don't think Tom got hacked. I think Tom Anderson has been steered very clear of this. I think he learned very well from the MySpace days, when MySpace was just an HTML and JavaScript dumpster fire of vulnerabilities, that if it existed today, it would have been 10 times worse in terms of stuff happening.
But, you know, if it wasn't for Tom Anderson, half of us wouldn't be into tech. Well, most of us. Or know how to do random amounts of HTML. And embed songs in our profiles.
Yes. I don't think I know half of the HTML tags if it weren't for MySpace. Or how to autoplay a video.
Right. Or embed a song.
Or literally how to embed the entirety of Pac-Man onto your site to replace a 404 page if the entire site went down, like that one time.
Yes!
On MySpace when it went down. I think that was like 06, 07. The whole site went down for so long. They were like, we're sorry, but here's Pac-Man. Go play Pac-Man.
I totally remember that.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who remembers that. It's random internet knowledge that probably might be lost to time if we didn't have these memories. Oh, MySpace, the dark days of InfoSec and the internet. But we learned.
We did learn. And now Tom Anderson, there's new updated photos. I bet that Tom Anderson is behind this Twitter thing, because all of a sudden he started popping up again.
You know, he went under the radar for so many years. I think he was doing some travel. You know, he kind of got out of the tech industry for a while, but now he's making his roaring debut back into the spotlight by taking out Twitter and reminding everyone Tom was here first. He was always your first friend.
Hashtag Tom Anderson.
Tom Anderson did everything. So that was Twitter. That wasn't even a topic, but it was things that happened this week. You know, I can't even keep up with things happening. Apparently Outlook went down for hours yesterday and I didn't even know about it.
Yeah, so Outlook had a major outage. Apparently they had done updates to Outlook that caused it to basically not work, for lack of better words. So it's the current click-to-run channel update dating back to June 30th. So if you're running that build, basically you didn't have Outlook yesterday for a good amount of time. Today it is resolved, and Microsoft will be issuing a report someday soon.
I'm very curious as to what caused that. Now that I am reading this, I do remember reading something in the patch management mailing list, but I thought it had chalked up to patches, and I thought it was just standard Office Patch Tuesday madness, but I don't know if that was a coincidence or just ill timing. But whatever that is, I'm curious as to what the incident report for this will be.
It'll be a very interesting read. Speaking of patch management, I think I got taken off that list, and I'm very sad about it.
It's not very hard to resubscribe to it. In fact, I know they changed it from Google Groups to, I think, a dedicated list.
Oh. And
I remember it was complicated when they first transitioned over, and I think I have instructions on how to resubscribe to patch management if you need them.
I do.
Yeah, so that... I think it is easier to get back onto that list now, but that is definitely the place to be for patches and everything.
I wonder if I just missed the update of like, hey, we're moving, and then I just never followed the instructions to move over.
I want to say that whole thing happened in about 2018 or so-ish, and it was kind of publicized, but kind of wasn't. And it was a little bit, it kind of trickled in because they kind of kept sending it reminder emails, and you always got that one guy who was like, hey, what's going on? How do I unsubscribe? How do I resubscribe? And blah, blah, blah. It was one of those things where if you missed it, you missed it. So
right.
It's possible folks on the older version of the list, maybe they didn't transfer it over or something. I don't quite remember what happened there.
Makes sense. Speaking of not supporting things, Office 2013 support end of life for M365 or Office 365, whatever you feel like calling it today. Basically, in the show notes, there will be a Office configuration support matrix of all the things that are end of life. Office 2013 will still be able to connect to O365 services, but there's no guarantee they will continue to work.
Oh, yes, because that... Does Office 2013 support Modern Auth currently?
Not out of the box. So you have to do a registry edit in order to get it to connect with Modern Auth. So if you turn off basic authentication, it won't do it automatically.
I see. So you already are at the disadvantage of having to update through the registry key. What about, so it's going end of support now, but is it just because for general support and updates?
So general support updates, but it's losing support on the Office 365 side of things. So they will no longer update whatever in their code to support it. So say they have an outage for modern authentication and your tenant doesn't have modern auth on, basically you're SOL.
Oh, absolutely. I could totally see that.
They're going to tell you that you need to upgrade your client.
Because that would put you in the same class as Office 2010, which I believe doesn't support Modern Auth whatsoever, I think.
Right. Last year, Microsoft disabled the HTTP over RPC or to RPC.
Yes. That was the thing I was thinking of, but couldn't remember the name of.
Speaking of not doing that, cool your jets.
Probably in lieu of a better topic for this week, I think I wanted to just briefly talk about sysadmins and the overall etiquette of the industry and things I've observed over the years in my not brief but not long life as a sysadmin. Things that kind of tend to be frowned upon or be smiled upon. The point of this is don't be that sysadmin. There's things that I've noticed in just behavioral things that folks do as sysadmins that tends to contribute to the stereotype that sysadmins are grumpy IT people that are not fun to work with, not easy to work with, and always say no to everything. This is my little pep talk on little things you can do to not piss people off and be a good sysadmin in the sysadmin world.
So what do you do, Steve, to not make people mad?
One of the things that I'm pretty sure I didn't come up with, but I never hear anyone else talk about, so I'll say it's patented by me, is called the 5-minute rule, or the 5-minute reply rule, if you will. Say it's Monday morning, you're getting absolutely lit up on Teams, Skype, Carrier Pigeon, people are walking up to your cube, they're emailing you, you know, every which angle you could possibly be contacted, you're being contacted. When you are in this unique situation, and when I say unique, I mean it might be frequent and not so unique and happens to everyone, to mentally triage all of this, you might also be looking at alerts from the weekend and trying to just figure out which way is up. What I have done, which tends to be a bit of a winning strategy, is let's start with IMs. Those are the most urgent and, you know, I need this now kind of thing. So if someone messages you and says, hey, I need this thing, or it starts out with, hey, I have a question for you, just do this one simple thing. Instead of immediately replying to them with maybe, hey, busy, or no, or blah, 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 whatever it is that you might type out and then send without actually thinking it out and then realizing, oh, that probably didn't land well. What you can do is just don't reply for maybe about 5-ish minutes. And there's something about that 5 minutes where if you just let it go, sometimes the person who's messaging you, I don't know what causes this, but they may message you say, never mind, I figured it out. Or they'll give you some extra crucial detail that you needed originally that may have made you rage reply.
It's so true. I do that all the time. And I see so many people that I work with, like, and they'll be like jumping right on it. And I'm like, this is why people are literally on top of you all the time. It's not that you don't want to provide them good service, but it's like, if you give people space and time, they'll give you more details and they'll actually honestly be easier to work with.
Right. So they're shooting from the hip, and then there's kind of taking the measured, slightly delayed, you know, I think of the sloths in, what was that Disney movie with the rabbit?
Zootopia.
Zootopia. Yeah, the sloths in Zootopia. Maybe not as slow as them, but if you just imagine you get a message and you just kind of just let it sit, and it's for the benefit of not only you, but for the other person, because they also have to think about what they just sent you as well, because there's a chance they also fired it off to you, you know, without thinking it through anyway. So you just kind of sit, you maybe give it up. Literally 5 minutes is all you need, sometimes even less. But just let it sit and simmer, almost like a pie that came out of the oven and is sitting on the windowsill, and wait for extra details, or just wait for your own brain to just cool and then reply, and it will just make everything better. The other thing that this applies to in a slightly different manner is with email. We know with email, email isn't great as a communication medium. We've evolved as a species beyond email a little bit with Teams. We've attempted to evolve, but a lot of times some people just like to continue emailing with single sentence emails that could be better as an IM or something. So a lot of times those come in and you feel really tempted to just hit Control R and just fire something off, whatever literally streams out of your brain, you know, just go right from you to them. You can continue to do that, but one small suggestion from me. When you're replying to emails, before you do this, set up a little inbox rule in Outlook that basically just says, hey, just when I press the send button in Outlook, just kind of make that email hang out in the outbox for about 3 to 5 minutes, depending on what you feel. And what it will do is it'll basically delay sending the email and allow you to either jump into your outbox folder and edit and resend it, or you can delete it. And because you may have that sender's remorse of, oh crap, that was worded really badly, or I could have made that sound way less salty than it actually was. It's better to read that in your outbox than to see it in your sent items folder.
That is very true.
Yes. I find this happens to me all the time. There's something psychological about getting the pure dopamine satisfaction of reading an email you sent with your own words and seeing it in the sent folder. There's something about that I don't understand that feels really good, but you kind of need to retrain your brain a little to get that same feel, but with it sitting in the outbox folder where you can unsend or edit.
I don't have words for this.
I feel like I'm like a sysadmin psychiatrist tonight.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're like Dr. Phil, but at night.
Yeah, how long have I been in IT? Like technically eight years professionally. I think I kind of figured this out maybe about 5-ish years ago, but when I was working a job where I was like one of the only IT people on site and I had to field a lot of support questions literally all day, not only internally, but externally with customers. And I remember it just wore me down after a while, but I kind of came up with a system where I was like, you know, especially with email is not really necessarily intended to be immediate like an IM. So why not play on that a little bit and just say, let's delay this by X amount of minutes. And that way we can craft a slightly better quality response and maybe a little less toxic and salty while we're at it.
Exactly. You don't need salt on your email.
No.
It doesn't taste that great.
Make it peppery. Add some, what other spices that are not as offensive than just raw salt and maybe a little bit easier on your heart and others' hearts.
Facts.
What else? Facts. What else do we got? So that was, so that's the patented 5-minute reply rule for both IMs and emails. It just kind of works and you'll feel better. Others will feel better. It might just make the mood better. Other kind of things. I call this the D-bad rule. Don't be a dingus. If you're going to, this kind of plays on the 5-minute rule, but at the same time, it's like, just sit down and think when you're replying to people. Just kind of be personable. One thing that really gets on my nerves when I see other people reply or whatever is if they reply with like a sentence that barely makes any sense, with grammar and spelling being all over the place, or it's overly technical and it's not composed for the audience in mind, that can really wear on people, especially if it's a higher up or a manager or a manager's manager. It might not reflect well on you over time. Things like that, it can really help you in the long run just to word things friendly and in a technical writing mindset where you just keep it kind of short, sweet, but also understand the audience you're writing for.
Very true.
And lastly, in a lot of things you say, just be objective. There's been a lot of times where other coworkers or colleagues have come to me and they've actually come to me with drafts of messages they want to send. And I'll go through and read it. I will tell them, I'll come back to them and say, okay, you wrote like 3 paragraphs. 2.5 of the 3 paragraphs you wrote are kind of a personal vendetta against this person. And I understand you kind of don't like this person in the first place, but can we rewind this a little bit? Delete maybe the last paragraph and a half, 2 paragraphs, and just get back to the very first sentence you wrote, which was golden, and leave it at that. You don't need to like state a manifesto on why this person is wrong and how wrong they are. It's Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, and dang it, we all just want to go home. And we don't want to cause some explosion that's going to come roaring back to us 10 times worse on a Monday morning.
Very true.
When you're replying, I know it's really hard, but just sit back and just say, just be objective. Just state the facts. And whatever problem you have with them, I don't know, open up notepad.exe and just blow them up in there. But you know what? There's no send button in Notepad.
Right.
They can't ever see what you send in Notepad.
Yeah, leave the vendettas out. It's ungood. It creates the toxicity.
Yeah, it's toxicity. And it's just, there's something about that kind of environment I've noticed when I see that kind of writing and personality attitude conflicts and clashes, that it's just, I'm just like, I can see this not going well for you. So these are just my little tips on how to avoid that whenever possible.
Facts.
There was a nice little Reddit thread on sysadmin for little tips here and there. It gets a little bit more technical than what I aim to talk about tonight, but those are there as well. I'll link that in the show notes. That is don't be that sysadmin. Don't be a dingus. D-bad.
The D-bad. Speaking of being a dingus, yeah, let's talk about last week. So instead of Steve does PowerShell, we're going to talk about how Tiff breaks PowerShell.
This is the upside down sequel, Tiff's Breaks PowerShell.
Yeah. So last week I was playing around with the Teams preview module. Well, I was breaking it mostly. So I had the older version. I wanted to play around with some of the channel functionalities that are in the preview. So adding users, removing users to channels and so forth. Upon trying to play with it, I realized that I had an older version installed. I like made a huge deal about it, and I even like contacted my TAM, and he was like trying to get somebody over this error for me, a PFE, when it turns out that I really just had 2 versions installed. I had 1.0.4, I believe, installed with the 1.0.25, which is the current preview.
It would have been really funny if like your TAM got like someone like maybe 3 levels higher than him, maybe someone who like reports to Satya or something.
Yeah, that would have been really embarrassing. He was like, I'm going to send this error over to a PFE. And finally, I messaged him and I was like, yeah, by the way, that was totally...
Please don't call Microsoft 911.
An RTFM moment. So,
don't you hate that?
Yeah.
I've done that at work a couple times where I've like called in the best of the best, and maybe 10 minutes later, it's like, oh God, I figured this out. I feel so dumb. I need to send a bunch of emails now telling people, never mind.
Yeah, never mind. Stop. So as I'm going through it and trying to figure it out, and I mean, like 2 hours went by, and then finally I go into the directories folder and I realize that they're both still there, and I just delete the previous one, because what would happen is every time I tried to connect it, the Teams module, it would allow me to connect, but if I ran the commandlets, it would just say this is not an available commandlet. Finally, I was like, come on, is this a modern auth problem? Because the tenant that I work in, it's not on. Finally, I went to that directories folder and I just deleted the older version, restarted Visual Studio Code, and sure enough, it worked just fine.
Ta-da.
Ta-da!
So you're doing it in Visual Studio Code. We're using the PowerShell integrated console versus the actual PowerShell?
Yes. Okay,
so that possibly could have been why. So it's kind of confusing. How do I describe this? In Visual Studio Code, there is a special isolated version of PowerShell that runs in that little terminal, and it's called the PowerShell Integrated Console, and it uses a different PowerShell profile and in some cases different directories for modules and the like compared to your system PowerShell, which is Windows PowerShell. And let's also not get started about PowerShell 7, which also uses different directories. So depending on which of the three editions of PowerShell you could possibly be running at any given time, I could see where you might have maybe gotten a little bit tripped up on where the module might have been loaded, or if you had duplicates, or where it was running in one window versus not in Visual Studio Code or whatever.
That actually makes a lot of sense now.
Because there's one problem with PowerShell, and it's fragmentation of versions. Because Microsoft never really likes to keep one solid version of something. They just keep the other one around for compatibility reasons until the end of time. And we're seeing that happen with PowerShell 5.1, PowerShell 6, PowerShell 7, and PowerShell 7 running as PowerShell Integrated Console in Visual Studio Code, and all kind of do their own thing in terms of their working directories.
I believe I still see 4.1 out there too. I don't know. Old versions.
Yeah. So you broke PowerShell and then you fixed PowerShell.
Yes.
And
then I was able to finally write some scripts to get channels working the way I wanted. It's actually pretty cool to be able to add and remove users directly to channels. So I wrote this whole script just to find out that I didn't need to do that.
Oh, really?
Was yeah.
Was it like a function or something?
No. So the scope of the project changed. So
oh, geez, really?
I had done all of that work and then I got a call like, basically, when I had gone through all of that, that was like, yeah, by the way, we're not going to let them do it that way. So you don't need to do this anymore.
That is the worst when you've gone down such a rabbit hole only to be told, yeah, we're not going to do this anymore.
Which is fine because I have to come up with a whole Teams governance plan. So it was fine because I need to work on that anyways. And this helps me sort of figure that out. I mean, I don't know how it's related at all, but I learned some stuff and it was great.
So as long as you learned and got something out of it, that's the best way of looking at it. Because, wow, in enterprise IT, I could not tell you how many times this ever happened to me where I was like, no, I got the solution. It's working beautifully. Oh, we're not going to do it. And I'm like, I'm going to finish it anyway because I've come too far now to just drop it.
I can't just turn back now.
Seriously.
Oh, anyways.
Speaking of turning back now, we have an unplanned outage and a sponsor. So hope this helps. This week is helped by Team Smells. Smell your coworkers remotely. The smell of that conference room, the smell of the break room, the smell of your smelly coworker who just came back from the gym. All of that coming soon to Team Smell Mode. Using the same technology that we use to blur the backgrounds, we actually have used that same AI-powered atmospheric enhancements to bend the molecules in your house using the sound waves coming out of your speakers, your headphones, and sync that with the microphone feeding back into your coworkers' auditorial environments to simulate a perfect office smell environment. So coming soon to a brand new update for Teams Click to Run this fall, Teams Smell Mode.
Wait, is this just like Smell-O-Vision?
Microsoft has achieved Smell-O-Vision after 30 plus years of research. It has finally happened, and it is debuting in Teams to get an edge over all of the other video conferencing software that is available.
I will never forget when I worked at the Apple store and this guy came in and he really swore up and down that he had invented Smell-O-Vision and was dead serious about it.
It wasn't just like some guy just farting up a chair in a living room in front of his tube, was it?
No, he had like this whole product basically designed and so forth and this idea of how it would work and basically would come in and tell us, like try to pitch to us. We were like 20-year-old kids and he's like, guys, I have this really great idea. It's Smell-O-Vision.
I don't even want to know how he would have even concocted such a thing.
No.
Clearly wouldn't have worked because we're not talking up and down the hill about this guy in 2020.
No. I think he was just some random guy who would come into the store looking for people to talk to.
You know, retail.
But he was the Smell-O-Vision guy.
Back in my day when I worked retail, I met a lot of people who invented a lot of things, let me tell you.
One time I did sell an iPhone to Dean Kamen, and I had no idea who he was.
See, that's a man who actually has invented a lot of things.
I know.
A lot of great things.
I just remember he just looked at me and he's like, you don't know who I am? And I was like, no, I don't.
That must feel really great. Like, imagine being really famous and you just hate being stopped every 5 feet on the street. And you just talk to some dude who has no clue who you are. And you're like, wow, thank you. Thank you for not knowing.
He was actually really insulted.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. He was like, what do you mean you don't know who I am? And I was like, I really don't. I was like 20 years old. I worked at the Apple store. Like, I'm like, I don't know anything about you.
Really? You don't know me? DK? I'm like, Donkey Kong? No, Dean Kamen. The guy who does FIRST Robotics, the guy who invented the Segway, the guy who does all this amazing stuff, who's trying to literally 3D print organs to save lives, that Dean Kamen.
That guy.
You don't know me?
Well, now
you
I
know
do.
Who I am?
Well, now I do. I think that's the most embarrassing moment of my life because I was just like, no, I don't know who you are.
That was what, 2009, 2010-ish?
Yeah.
Oh, no, he was fairly big back then.
He was probably pretty big. I just was very new to the area as well. I grew up in Western Mass. We didn't have FIRST Robotics.
Yeah, like, that makes sense. There were national competitions back then, but FIRST Robotics was not nearly as big back then as it is now. Source, I was in FIRST Robotics from like 2006 to 2008.
I didn't even know what it was until I moved up to this area.
I went to the nationals competitions back when they were held in Atlanta.
What?
I don't think that's a thing anymore. I think they have worldwide competitions now.
Right.
Back when we could go places and have, you know, competitions places.
Well, they got rid of those, like the ones where you go places, and now they do regional, and then you go on to like the nationals and so forth.
Oh, that makes sense.
So you stay local now.
Oh, so they kind of broke it up into regions because it got so big.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Source, my friend's parents run the Merrimack FIRST Robotics team.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the team I used to be on kind of disbanded and kind of got shuffled around, and I don't even know if it's even a thing anymore. So.
Oh, right, because they lost their space.
They lost the space, which was the place, that was the area that I, when I was there, was where we worked and did everything. And yeah, then they got passed around, and I don't know if Team 151 is a thing anymore.
But I don't know either. Interesting.
I don't know. Tough Techs Team 151, if you're out there. My hat goes off to you because we had good times in the 2000s.
All right. Now that we've talked about a lot of useless things, let's talk about more useless things that are actually tech related.
Yeah. So useless off-topic things. Let's talk about useless on-topic things. Useless obsolete knowledge you didn't ask for.
Dun, dun, dun.
In our brand new segment, we are going to be talking about HP ProCurve switches, particularly the 2824 and the 5406ZL. These things are beasts. For those who are not in the know, HP ProCurve, I don't know if it's even a thing anymore. HP Enterprise, it was their ProCurve switch line for probably the 2000s and 2010s. I'm not sure if they're still in the business anymore. I believe they might have sold it to another company, which I wish I wrote down. I can't remember. These things are magnificent switches, at least for their time and even to this day. If you can find them in places like eBay or somewhere secondhand, they're wonderful, mostly because they have lifetime warranties and they are capable of gigabit Ethernet and management and a lot of modern networking features that are still applicable today. I don't know if you'd want to use this in an enterprise setting, aside from maybe a test environment. Nonetheless, it's worth hunting down. They have their random quirks. There's random problems they tend to have sometimes if they're under a lot of load, like a fully loaded 4-8 module 5406ZL ProCurve switch might need a reset maybe once or twice a week just for random reasons of dropping packets or just kind of all sorts of craziness. When I worked a job, we had all HP ProCurve networking equipment all over the campus, and our core switch would occasionally just need a reboot. It could have been days, sometimes could be multiple times in the same day, sometimes it could be over the course of several months. It was just random, and we never figured out why it happened. As long as you're not taxing it too hard like that, they are wonderful. They are very modular. They support fiber. They support 10, 100, 1000 Ethernet. But the problem is they are aging a little bit, particularly with the 2824. The web UI is Java only, and you can only access it if you set certain security settings into very insecure modes for modern day, where you, on the client end, you have to go to java.security in the installation folder, and you need to set a property called jdk.jar.disabledalgorithms equals md2, md5, RSA key size less than 1024. And if you've made it to the end of that sentence, you're probably already cringing. If you comment that line out and then you add the IP of the server to your exceptions and Java's properties in the control panel, you can get to it, and then you have to launch Internet Explorer to load it, or maybe Firefox if the Java plugin is still supported by the time you're reading this, which may not be for very long. Who knows? That's how you can get into the web UI. However, you can enable Telnet, which can enable SSH. Then you can turn off Telnet. And then you can, with the right client, perhaps PuTTY, Windows subsystem for Linux doesn't seem to like SSHing into HP Procurve switches due to the encryption being too old or out of date. And I haven't yet figured out how to get past that yet. But PuTTY has no problem connecting to it. And you can do almost everything the web UI can via SSH. The commands are very similar to Cisco switches. So if you're familiar with the Cisco world, you'll feel almost very much at home with HP Procurve switches, and you can configure it, you can VLAN things, you can tag things, you can control speed, duplex, you can name ports, you can turn ports on and off, you can set rate limits, all kinds of things. The lovely thing is these servers are really easy to back up, restore. The larger ones in particular, the 5406ZL, have CF cards in them, so you can back them up, you can swap them in and out. HPE's lifetime warranty on these is basically no matter how old these get, they still have to support it. And if you enter the serial code into HPE's site, they always add 100 years to the current date, and they say that's when the end of support date will be. Whenever you get them on the support, they have to oblige, and you got to just go through the usual support thing with them. They will eventually ask for you to ship back the switch, and they'll just send you another one, be it a module or the whole thing. Based on the scarcity of these parts, they might end up eBaying these or maybe refurbishing them by farming it out to another company or something, but a lifetime warranty is a lifetime warranty. So you gotta hold it to them. That's HP Procurve switches. Maybe not so great for enterprise anymore, but man, if you can get them for home use, they are really awesome. That is the story of HP Procurve.
What and why?
Because I couldn't think of anything else to talk about this week.
Honestly, that's the most obscure thing, and I'm okay with that.
You know, we could talk about obscure things. I'm not against that.
No, I think it's really interesting. I think it's really interesting.
Everything I just mentioned was pretty much personal experience.
I figured.
Worked at a place that had all of these there and having to support these on the daily.
That's pretty cool, though, the lifetime warranty.
Yeah, that is really funny. You don't see that a lot anymore, especially with products. And they don't seem to care necessarily if the product is used in the enterprise anymore. If it just at one point had it and you still have it now, there's a chance they will just oblige.
That's so awesome. All right.
Yeah.
Well, which brings us to this week's segment of That Is Accurate.
That is accurate.
So, Steve, what is accurate this week?
On this week's That Is Accurate, PowerShell's original name was Monad. Exchange 2007 was one of the very first products to really take advantage of PowerShell, then known as Monad.
That is accurate.
That is accurate. Yes, Exchange was one of the forerunners of getting PowerShell off the ground and kind of Microsoft's way of proving it as, hey, this is our next generation command line interface. Look at how we can manage such a behemoth such as Exchange, which previously was a lot of GUI or just obscure VB script
or
CMD.
So much Visual Basics. If you didn't know VB, like, you were just using the GUI and not doing a whole lot else.
Absolutely. So that really put PowerShell on the map. After that, it was slowly integrated into other products. I believe my first exposure to PowerShell was Active Directory, and then it became Exchange and SCCM of all things. SCCM actually has a lot of PowerShell support, which is wonderful. You can do a lot of what the UI does in SCCM PowerShell.
That is awesome. I honestly find it very hard to administer Exchange without any PowerShell experience.
I remember as of a couple of years ago, I think I challenged myself. I said, I know Microsoft is slowly going in the direction of diminishing the UI in Exchange, or at least trying to de-emphasize it in favor of Office 365, but the PowerShell support is still wonderful and they are not backing down from that. So I really kind of pushed myself to try to do everything in the PowerShell side of Exchange. And nowadays, there's actually a lot of things I don't know how to do in the GUI, but sure know how to do in PowerShell with Exchange. And that's a wonderful state to be in.
There's a lot of things you can't do in the GUI that you can do with PowerShell for Exchange.
That as well. Yes, they're slowly removing or obscuring features in the GUI that is just trivial as a PowerShell commandlet.
Right, and there's a lot of things that just don't exist anyways.
Precisely.
That you really have to know PowerShell to get through.
What was the thing I was thinking of? I think if you're in a hybrid configuration with PowerShell, you cannot configure in a distribution group restricted senders lists anywhere but PowerShell, I believe.
I believe so.
I think like the UI is kind of still there, but it's either grayed out or it doesn't work, or you can't actually edit anything in that field. You might be able to view the members, but you can't edit them, as far as I understand.
I think
and
you're
this
right.
This is as of Exchange 2016 and Office 365 hybrid. So.
Yeah, it's getting a little bit dicey now.
So you got to brush up on the PowerShell, formerly known as Monad. It's come a long way since 1.0 back in the Windows XP days.
I really love this one blurb in the article that says Exchange 2007 is a major league, high volume, high stress production application. And it is using Windows PowerShell as the core for its entire admin experience. But now you look back and you're like, what? Wait, what?
It's like back then, I think, 1.0 of PowerShell, it was all right, but man, it still had a little ways to go.
Exchange 2007 is a major league, high volume, high stress production. And you're like, no, yeah, it is.
We've come a long way since 2007.
Wow, this is like a way back machine, going back in time.
I really dug deep to find this press release for Windows PowerShell 1.0. You can count on it shipping. Did it ship? Now we have too many versions of PowerShell.
I know.
Now we have PowerShell 5.1 built into the OS and probably can't be separated from the OS at this point. But you got the new PowerShell 7. You got PowerShell 6 if you jumped on that train for a little while before 7 became popular. Wow. Yeah, what a journey.
This is also so good, too. We also did a big consistency pass on CMDlets and our commandlets. CMDlets is so me like 5 years ago. This article has put me into like this past self. Their commandlets and their...
I love whoever wrote this. The one you'll all go goo-goo over is tab completion.
This is so good. This article is the best.
The dude who wrote this was so excited about PowerShell when he wrote this.
I bet it's the same person who met their wife and had the whole Squeaky the Lobster thing.
Probably.
And this has to be.
This wasn't Jeff Snover who wrote this, was it?
It feels like it could be.
JPS.
That could be Jeffrey something Snover.
Well, that might be his initials, actually. Oh my god, citation needed. Is this Jeff Snover?
Jeffrey PowerShell Snover.
His middle name was PowerShell.
Yeah, that's where he gave it the name. Hold on. Was this really Jeff Snover who did that?
He kind of does write like this, GPS. Like on his Twitter.
Yeah,
he kinda
does
that, but he kind of writes in that sarcastic, funny tone.
Right, because I kind of was reading it in his voice the whole time.
This probably was him. This was, the 1.0 days, he was probably super heavily involved in it back then.
Oh, yeah, for sure. A marquee name. I'm not making this up. This was Jeff. Like, if you read the bottom, where he puts in quotes, marquee name, where he's, like, basically making fun of, like, the marketing department.
Yeah, this is totally Jeff. Wow, Jeff. Wonderful article. This is one for the museum.
This is great. I
put it up on the wall next to the Constitution.
Right. But, I mean, this is probably just as good at this point. Anyways.
Okay, so that was a wholesome that is accurate for this week.
In case you
missed it, PowerShell's original name was Monad. Monad asked the stiff's question of the week time.
Yeah, woo!
Hey. So the question of the week this week is, do you listen to music while working? And if you do, with lyrics or without?
I do. Sometimes I actually put on a TV show.
I am mostly a lyricless, soft music while working person. And when I start adding lyrics or podcasts or maybe even video, I start to honestly get derailed in what I'm doing. It's just something about sensory overload. So I have to be lyricless and it has to be kind of quiet background kind of genres.
Like the Weather Channel music?
Yeah, like the Weather Channel, the local forecast music.
I like to listen to the Disney theme park music.
That's not bad. I have some Disney piano music. Mm. I have some atmospheric kind of ambience with some light piano in the background. I have some tracks that are literally just recordings of rain or things like that.
That's nice.
Just whatever it is that could be kind of calming, but I don't have to waste a lot of brain power on processing like something with a lot of deep lyrics. Some folks talk about coding and listening to podcasts. I can't do that. When I listen to a podcast and code, like my code becomes gross and error-ridden and it's nasty.
Honestly, I can write PowerShell when I'm listening to metal, but I think it's because a lot of the words are just incoherent.
If it's something where I can't really understand it to begin with and I don't need to focus on it, it's fine. Or if it's like a song I've heard a billion times and I don't need to process it, I can allow that, but anything more complex than that, I can't really do.
That's why usually the shows that I do watch in the background, they're things I've already seen, like The Office or Bob's Burgers, things like they're just familiar sounds and just ambient noises at that point.
Right. Yeah. Just things you've heard before and are capable of doing other things alongside.
Background noise.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the question of the week. I think we have reached finally the end of the show. And we are at time, I think, at about an hour. So we are hope this helps. We are a weekly-ish podcast. We're sysadmins. We have a website, hthpc.com. We're on iTunes. We're on almost every platform you can think of. Just search us. You'll probably find it. Rate us on iTunes if you'd like. It helps us with metric-y thingies. We don't really care too much, but at the same time, we kind of do. So if you don't mind rating us on iTunes, then check us out on our Twitter, our website, our Twitch, or anywhere we're around as usual.
Facts. We'll be back.
Facts.
Probably next week.
Yeah, so I think we might probably count on it. We'll be back next week for more sysadmin fun, and we'll find out what gets breached next week or what else blows up all over the place next week, or have topics and all sorts of fun stuff. So until then, we hope this helps.
Bye.
Bye.